Psalm 143. So I was looking up something in an earlier psalm today and just happened to notice that we started this series in the Psalms in February 2020. 4 years ago, we started this series in the Psalms. So, just another 4 years to go, and we'll be graduated from the Psalms. But actually, after tonight, we only have seven of them left. But I really didn't think it had been that long. I knew it had been a little while, but anyway, so a testament of perseverance, I suppose. Probably more of yours than mine. All right, so we are looking at Psalm 143. Start with our summary statement here. Psalm 143, praise for Yahweh. To deliver the soul of his servant through his unfailing righteousness. So I'll go over that again. Psalm 143, praise for Yahweh to deliver the soul of his servant through his unfailing righteousness. Simple outline for the psalm is two parts, verses 1 to 6, requests to be heard. Verses 7 to 12, petitions for deliverance. And I'll go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 6, requests to be heard. Verses 7 to 12, petitions for deliverance. All right, so we'll go to our observations. Psalm 143 was written by David. You can see the superscription there, a psalm of David. So the superscription ascribes it to him. The word for psalm that is used, we've seen it numerous times, mismor, which indicates instrumental accompaniment. And there's also a selah that comes at the end of verse number 6. And so this would be the musical direction that is given in the psalm for the singing of the psalm. There is no occasion that is given. There some traditional views place it during David's flight from his son Absalom. But there's really no compelling evidence for that to be the occasion. It could be that. It could also be numerous other occasions in David's life, because the psalm is not anywhere near specific enough to try to pin it down to one occasion. So I really don't see any indication of a particular occasion. Psalm 143, to categorize it, it is a lament. And it does follow mostly the conventions of a lament. So verse 1, you have direct address prayer to God with requests to be heard. Verse 2 features a petition. Verses 3 to 4, crisis complaint. Verses 5 and 6 give an expression of confidence. Verses 7 to 10 give petitions for deliverance. And verses 11 and 12 give another expression of confidence. So there's no praise or vow or commitment to praise at the end of this lament, but another expression of confidence. There are some minor elements of this psalm as well. In fact, there are some penitential elements, and we recently looked at a lament that did not have penitential elements, which makes it be the righteous sufferer. But the penitential laments is some sort of confession, of sin, some sort of confession of unrighteousness. Now, this is a penitential psalm because you do have this confession in verse 2. It's not confession of a particular sin that has caused the crisis or anything like that, but it is a confession of unrighteousness, and that would be deemed as an unworthiness before God. So it does have penitential elements. It also has imprecatory elements. And again, compared to some of the more recent ones we've seen, they seem rather mild. But really, there's not really any difference. Just the language of the expression is really all that's different. Remember, an imprecation is a prayer of condemnation. It's a prayer for God's wrath, and meaning God's final wrath to come on the enemies. And so you do have some imprecations in this particular psalm. This Psalm 143 is the sixth of this final David group of psalms. So that begins in Psalm 138 and goes to Psalm 145. So there are two more after this one. This is also, we've had a series over the last few psalms of laments, and this is also the last of the laments that you are going to encounter in the book of Psalms. It's the last of the penitential psalms you're going to encounter in the book of Psalms as well. When we consider the connections that Psalm 143 has, certainly it does connect with this David group. So we've seen a number of themes in these psalms of this last David group of psalms, themes of affliction and distress and persecution and enemies and life and death. And so it does connect with these other psalms in this group. It has particular connection with Psalm 142, the one just before it. You have reference to trouble or tribulation, to supplication, to being overwhelmed in spirit, persecution, failing, references to life and death. And so there's a numerous connections between these two psalms. And also there were some commentaries that noted around 40 similarities with statements in this psalm to other psalms. And so it's quite a list that you looked at. I mean, every verse had at least one, and most of the verses had three or more references. And these would be expressions in other places in the psalms that are very similar, whether it's similar in concept or similar in language or imagery or whatever that it is. But there's a lot of similarity. So it's one of those kind of psalms that seems like it's almost sort of a collection, you know, of things from various psalms. Now, the poetic features of Psalm 143 would be what I would call a thematic repetition. So sometimes in repetition, you just have the same word repeated over and over. This is more thematic, where you've got a repetition of words that it's not the same word, and not necessarily, some cases it's synonyms, sometimes it's not necessarily synonyms, but there are related words around some sort of concept or idea. So for instance, in this psalm, we get petitions 15 times. Now, not the word petition, but these are petitions, just like the psalm starts, "Hear my prayer, O Lord." So that's a direct address petition to the Lord. And you've got 15 of them in this psalm. In fact, this psalm is dominated by petitions, and probably, I would guess, it might have the most even out of the laments. I'm not sure. I didn't actually check that, but it is very dominated by petitions. And so that's a repetition through the psalm, this continual petitioning. References to God's attributes such as faithfulness, righteousness, steadfastness, and such. There's about six different times that we have that. We have references to soul or spirit or life or heart or something like that 10 different times in the Psalms. We have expressions of trust. And again, these use all different words. But that's the concept, and that's 5 times. And then we twice get the word for servant, the ebed, which is equivalent to the doulos in the Greek word which should be translated slave, and is most often translated as servant or bond servant or something like that. But this is the equivalent word in the Hebrew Ebed, servant. And that actual word appears at the beginning and at the end of the psalm. So that is an obvious poetic feature, the repetition, this thematic repetition. The psalm does use some imagery, expressions like thirsting like a parched land. In other words, the image being a dried and dusty land that's thirsting for the rain, thirsting for the water, the moisture. Also, the hearing in the morning, and we'll talk a little more about that morning as the metaphor and the way that it works here as well as in other psalms when we get to that. So there is some imagery in the psalm as well. All right, so we have 12 verses here, and we want to work through these verses, and I want to start by reading this psalm. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Give ear to my supplications. In thy faithfulness answer me, and in thy righteousness. And enter not into judgment with thy servant, for in thy sight shall no man living be justified. For the enemy hath persecuted my soul. He hath smitten my life down to the ground. He hath made me to dwell in darkness as those that have been long dead. Therefore is my spirit overwhelmed within me. My heart within me is desolate. I remember the days of old. I meditate on all thy works. I muse on the work of thy hands. I stretch forth my hands unto thee. My soul thirsteth after thee as a thirsty land. Selah. Hear me speedily, O Lord. My spirit faileth. Hide not thy face from me, lest I be like unto them that go down into the pit. Cause me to hear thy loving kindness in the morning, for in thee do I trust. Cause me to know the way wherein I should walk, for I lift up my soul unto thee. Deliver me, O Lord, from mine enemies. I flee unto thee to hide me. Teach me to do thy will, for thou art my God. Thy spirit is good. Lead me into the land of uprightness. Quicken me, O Lord, for thy name's sake. For thy righteousness' sake, bring my soul out of trouble. And of thy mercy, cut off mine enemies, and destroy all them that afflict my soul. For I am thy servant. So verse 1 gives us this opening prayer, and again, it's direct address to the Lord. And we see this repetition, hear, give ear, and answer. And these are the petitions that start this particular psalm. And these requests to be heard and to be answered, we've seen it. It's common in the lament psalms, and it's also indicative of a covenantal prayer. There's a reason why the psalmist is asking to be heard, that he has an expectation of being answered. And in some ways, as we go through this and we talk about the different verses, then we talk about the interpretation and such, in some ways we could call this almost a model lament, not because it necessarily maybe is the best example of the conventions of a lament, but in this lament is explicit statements that are oftentimes implicit in other laments. So you have requests to be heard, but it is made much more clear and obvious, in other words, what the standing is of the one who is praying in this. And maybe that'll make sense as we go on. So it's very pronounced in this psalm. We have a repetition of covenantal terms. I mean, they're just heaped up in this psalm. There's prayer, and you get down to the end, and he's praying for God's name's sake and such. So David's standing in this prayer is really, again, what is made very explicit in this psalm, and it's typically more implied. But we're going to look at that more as we go along. Also, there is an appeal here. You notice in verse 1, there is an appeal to God's faithfulness and to his righteousness. And again, when we see these words, especially all these words that are used together, heavy covenantal associations with them, faithfulness refers to trustworthiness. In other words, if you know how it is, if certain people make you a promise, you know that, well, that's never going to happen. You know, you're not going to set your clock or your calendar by that because, you know, it's just an empty promise. Their word's no good. So they're not trustworthy. On the other hand, the faithfulness of God that's being referred to is his trustworthiness. If God has said it, he will do it. He will do it without fail. And so therefore he is trustworthy. So David is appealing to God's trustworthiness as he is praying in this prayer. Righteousness refers to justice or just dealing. And again, we talked a little bit about righteousness in the Psalms. We've talked about it in different places as well. We talked about it in the Sermon on the Mount. How that when the righteousness of God is described, it's not some sort of you know, idyllic abstract standard that's floating around out here in the clouds. Typically, his righteousness is described in relation to. So it's in relation to. It's in relation to those he has made a covenant promise to. It's in relation to those who have rejected him, the wicked that are going to come into judgment. And he is right. He is just in his interaction and in his dealing with each of those different groups. So David's prayer on this basis implies that God has to hear an answer, as if God's obligated. And when you think about the terms, if you go through again, 15 petitions in this psalm, and they're all these strong imperatives, and you come away thinking this is a very bold prayer. And we've talked about that at different times with the laments. Like, some of these statements, they seem so bold. How could a person, you know, talk like this to God? So if you read this psalm through and just sort of think about what David is saying, and it's very bold, and it's almost as if he's calling God to account, that God is obligated. God has to hear and has to answer this request. So how do we account for that? Well, we'll see as we continue on in the psalm. So verse 2 gives us this confession, and this is this penitential element. And he talks about judgment. He's petitioning not for God not to enter into judgment with him. And the word for judgment here is very precise. It's a word that typically refers to a judicial verdict. So he's saying, don't render a judicial verdict or decision or sentence against me. That's what he's praying. He doesn't want judgment because of what he says in the second line, and that's the fact that nothing living is justified or righteous in God's sight. So I know we have, shall no man living be justified. You may or may not have some italics there. The word for man is not actually there. It's more general than that. It's just that no living thing, no living being is righteous before God, is justified in his sight. So this is the penitential confession. And again, it's not confession of a specific sin that David is making, but it is a confession of unrighteousness, thorough unrighteousness. It's not just personal unrighteousness, but it's a confession of all unrighteousness among men. So in other words, David is praying a very bold prayer, and then at the same time declaring very plainly that he has no standing before God to pray this prayer. And he says, essentially saying, there's none that can stand in judgment with God. In other words, if God enters into judgment with you, and you stand before him of yourself, there is none that comes out of that judgment justified. None. So this confession helps to establish that David does not have standing for this prayer. And I'm using standing in sort of a legal sense. Like sometimes sometimes if you want to bring someone to court and you want to sue them, in some situations, you know, you have to have standing, and essentially you have a right. Maybe that's a better term. you have a right to be able to sue them so that it's, you know, it's not dismissed or something. And so does David have the right to pray this prayer to the Lord? And again, some very bold imperatives in this psalm. Well, this confession shows that there's nothing in David that guarantees that right or gives him that right. There's nothing in him that obliges God to act favorably toward him. So that seems to be a little puzzling. But it, again, it's very clear as we proceed in the psalm. Verses 3 and 4 then get into these issues of life and death. So this is where we get into this crisis complaint. And clearly the stakes are seen. The stakes are life and death. We have a repetitive reference to life and death here. So we have reference to soul, to life, to spirit, to the heart. David refers to being smitten or struck down or ground down to the ground, being in darkness with the dead, his heart being appalled, being stunned or in shock. So the enemy has afflicted, and the enemy is mentioned here in verse number 3, and the enemy has afflicted, and the goal seems to be David's destruction. That's the goal of the enemy's affliction. And the final phrase here, made me to dwell in darkness as those that have been long dead. This phrase is repeated almost exactly in Lamentations chapter 3 and verse number 6. And so Jeremiah makes use of this expression, and there in Lamentations, it's in reference to exile. So this figurative expression of death is figurative of exile. Spirit being overwhelmed means that he's faint and failing. In other words, it's a prayer. It's an urgent prayer that he is certainly in a desperate situation. The heart or mind is appalled or stunned into a stupor. We might even say in shock, which is really, when you read Lamentations, seems a very appropriate way to describe Jeremiah. He's in shock at what has happened and grappling to deal with that. Verses 5 and 6 now give us this expression of trust. And again, thematic repetition in the psalm. We have repetitive references to remembering, mark, meditate, ponder, these different, the meaning of these words that are used. And it's the days or the works of God's hands and such that are remembered. Now, the point of remembering is recalling God's past actions in faithfulness to his word. So one reason we read and study the Bible is to learn what God has promised to do and how God has kept those promises. So we look back in the Old Testament, in the ancient and far gone history to us, and we read of where God made promises, and then God acted because of those promises to keep them. And so remembering them functions essentially as a way of giving assurance that God is going to act in the future to yet fulfill his word. So even though we could look at the Bible and we could see a whole lot of prophecies that have been fulfilled, there's also a good number of prophecies that have not been fulfilled yet. And God's actions in past faithfulness give us assurance that he's going to continue and he's going to fulfill all of his word. And we get this expression, this imagery of prayer and worship, the lifting up of the hands and the soul and such to God. Verse 7 gives us another petition. And one of the things we've talked about with laments is that oftentimes laments have some sort of time element. There's usually an urgency that is expressed. Either it's implicit or explicit, but it's there in the lament. There's an urgency. Like if God, if you don't do something soon, you know, there's not going to be anything left of me. You know, I'm going to be done. I'm going to be, you know, in the grave or whatever. So laments commonly have that sort of a time element. And oftentimes it's in the form of that question, how long? How long, O Lord? We've seen that a number of times. Well, here we have this sort of a reference in this petition. It's a petition for quick response. Hear me speedily. Even the word and even has the idea of immediately. Hear me now, immediately. And, get rid of that little visitor. Okay. And so to in other words, the urgency comes through again, this time element, you know, hear me now, immediately, speedily. And the reference to the hiding of God's face is, that's the refusal of his favor. If God hides his face from him, then in other words, then God's promises will not be fulfilled. And you see the stakes here as well. The stakes are going down into the pit. And we've seen this recently. It's an idiomatic reference to death in the grave. And notice how that David distinguishes between himself and them that go down into the pit. And he's basically saying that if you don't hear me speedily, you're going to make me like those that go down to the pit. What does that mean? Well, he's distinguishing himself from those who do not trust in Yahweh. So he trusts in Yahweh. He has taken refuge in him. You are my God, he confesses in this psalm as well as many others. And so he says, if you don't answer me, then you're going to make me like those who do not trust in you, whose God you are not. And if Yahweh hides his face, he doesn't answer, then David will be like those that are not in covenant relationship with him. Verses 8 to 10 give us this deliverance. And so the word for loving kindness there in verse 8, it is chesed. This word gets repeated again in verse number 12, common word, steadfast love, loyal love, unfailing love, mercy, loving kindness. There's all kinds of, when you look at, even in the Authorized Version, you look at many of the other translations, there's all kinds of words they use for this word. And generally it has covenantal associations, particularly when used in connection with other terms and things like in this psalm. Hearing of his chesed in the morning. Now, this use of the morning, it's a common metaphor for after a night of adversity. So it's like a long night. Think of a long night of a terrible storm, and then you get to the break of day, and the storm breaks and calms. And it's sort of this night of adversity. It's used this way, Psalm 30 in verse 5, Psalm 63 in verse 6, Psalm 130 in verse number 6 as well. And it also contributes to this timing of a speedy answer. You know, I want to hear in the morning. And generally, you're talking with someone maybe in the late afternoon or even in the evening, and I want to hear this in the morning. It means very quickly. And we get an expression of covenantal trust in Yahweh and this petition for guidance as well. Now, deliverance that is referred to, deliver me, O Lord, from mine enemies. Deliverance is that rescue, it's that ransom. And we have this imagery of hiding that complements the language of refuge in covenantal trust in Yahweh. And then, teach me to do your will. So God's will is his pleasure. It's what is acceptable to him, which is echoed from Psalm 40 and verse number 8. God's Spirit is the Holy Spirit. And there are only a few references in the Psalms to the Holy Spirit. Most of the use of this term, sometimes it refers to wind, which in the Hebrew it can refer to the wind, or it can refer to a spirit being. And you have to contextually discern which is which. But there's only a few references. Psalm 51, verses 11 to 12. Which Psalm 51, you remember, is a great penitential psalm, David's psalm of repentance and confession, where he's, you know, take not thy spirit away from me. Psalm 104, verse number 30, Psalm 139, and verse number 7, and here. And that's all the references that we have to the Holy Spirit, specifically in the Psalms. And the leading or the guiding of the Spirit that's referred to is interesting, because it's actually New Covenant language. So if you think about Ezekiel chapter 36 and verse 27, God promises to make a new covenant. He says to put my Spirit within you. And so they will obey his law or will. The land of uprightness is a very obscure reference, and we don't really have that complete reference echoed anywhere else. But really it describes this land or earth or ground of uprightness or righteousness. In other words, it's a description actually of the future kingdom where justice and righteousness dwell in all of the land or in all of the earth. And so we can see some of these terms and concepts together in Psalm 67 and verse 4, but also in the messianic prophecy in Isaiah chapter 11 and verse number 4 as well. Verses 11 and 12 that end this psalm give this petition to be made alive. Quicken me. The word does refer to making alive. It is a somewhat subtle resurrection language. Yahweh's name, sake, refers to his name as security for his covenant promises. Likewise, the reference to his righteousness, sake. Mercy is the repetition of chesed from earlier. And then the use of the language of cutting off, and we've seen that a number of times, and it's the language of disinheritance, of cutting off from the earth, cutting off from the land of the living, cutting off from the kingdom. Places like Psalm 18 and verse 40, Psalm 54 and verse 5, Psalm 69 and verse 4, Psalm 73 verse 27, Psalm 94 verse 23, Psalm 101 verses 5 and 8. And you notice that those that are cut off, if you trace that throughout the Psalms and the theology that is developed there, it's the enemies, it's the unbelieving, the rebellious, the wicked, the proud, the liars. And so this is the imprecatory part of the Psalm. And then we get the ending of the Psalm with this confession, I am thy servant. And that is Ebed, again, the equivalent of doulos in the Greek. And Ebed is actually specifically used as God's servant very little in the Old Testament. There are not many men that are referred to. Moses, I know, is. David is referred to as his servant. Isaiah has a primary usage of the servant of Yahweh, which is a messianic title. So there's not really very many men that are referred to that way in the Old Testament, but here we have it twice repeated in this psalm. All right, let's go to interpretation. Psalm 143 teaches the vast difference between God and men or mankind, human beings. David's confession here makes clear again what is implicit in the laments. He has nothing in or of himself to hold God accountable to hear and answer his prayer. So again, the language seems very bold to pray and to speak this way. And David even confesses that there's nothing in him or any other man for that matter that could bring God under obligation. So even though laments feature a crisis, and we have a crisis here. He is in danger of being ground into the earth, of being brought down into the pit and brought to the realm of the dead. There is a crisis here. So even though they feature a crisis complaint, and the crisis complaint explains the need or the trouble of the psalmist, but the need is not the basis of the expectation of the answer. In other words, when you read this lament, and again, this is a great lament to study because it is so explicit in this lament. When you read this lament and you see what David is confessing and you really see what are the rights that David are exercising here and how is God being called to account in this particular psalm, you realize that it's not anything in or of David, and it's also not the extremity of David's need. So it's not like David is praying on the basis and saying, look, Lord, I'm nothing of myself, but this is such a bad situation, you have to hear me. That's not the ground. That's not his standing in this psalm. So when we look at this psalm, there is this impassable separation between God and men. God's completely righteous. All men completely unrighteous. No one has merit before him. No one can earn standing before him. So this explains this bold language that we see in these laments, and particularly here. David could call God to account and seem to bring him under obligation. It's not because of David, but it's because of God. I mean, from the very start, he appeals to God's faithfulness and his righteousness. And he continues to make these appeals as you go through the psalm. He has this right, not because of himself or anything that he can do, but he has this right because of God. Because God has made promises to him. As one who has trusted in him, he has received these promises. It's because that God has sworn his own name as security for his promises. So therefore, God's righteousness, in essence, is on the line. If God were to fail to keep his word, and then he would forfeit his name. And obviously that will never happen. But that is the basis. That's the standing that David has. That's the rights that David has to pray this way. And so the messianic hope of this psalm is actually seen through the standing and the stakes of David in this prayer. Well, the stakes are very clear. Again, we've got this thematic repetition of life and death language. The stakes are life and death, going to the grave with the wicked, being cut off, being disinherited, being brought down by the enemies of God who oppose him and his anointed. And then we have the standing. Twice, David confesses himself to be the servant of Yahweh, which is obviously prefiguring the true servant of Yahweh. So this servant theme with David is actually something that was introduced in Psalm number 18, and it's repeated in other psalms, and a particularly significant one would be Psalm 116 and verse number 16, very important messianic reference where David refers to himself as a servant of Yahweh with obvious messianic implications. Because remember, those promises to David include the promise of the seed, the descendant, who will inherit the crown and David's throne forever. All right, let's go to application. I kept one main application here for reading this psalm as modern readers. Understanding Psalm 143 helps us understand that God owes us nothing. God didn't owe David anything. Again, David did not have standing before God to obligate God to him in any way of himself. So God's not beholden to us. He's not obligated to us. And in fact, God can only be obligated insofar as he is obligated in and of himself. In other words, God is obligated if God has obligated himself, and only in that case. He is not brought under obligation to anyone or anything outside of himself. So what this amounts to, as we read a psalm like this, is to understand that what we could never earn, what we could never merit of ourselves, we are given freely by God's grace and his righteousness.